Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and with me today is Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa.
We're in show number 79.
Uh-huh.
And I believe we're talking about the Iranian Revolution today?
We are, right. Okay. And we'll talk a little bit about Vatican foreign policy with that. And the great challenge that that this has, as we're aware, the Iranians are very close to a nuclear bomb, and so if you have that nightmare combination of jihadists, which we've been talking about for the last several weeks, and the capability of nuclear capability, that's a very dangerous thing.
It is a very scary
thought. So what we we left off with last time around was we were taking a look at Iran during happier days, during the days when the Shah was still in power. That might have been happy for some of us, but it was not happy for others. Mm-hmm. There were others, as we mentioned last time, that chafed under his leadership and under his control. Some of those being people on the left, secularists, who had experienced the heavy-handedness of his secret police. Others on the other side, fundamentalists, his dealing with the Islamic religion, although he himself is Muslim. The country is, the vast majority of Iran is Muslim also. But he was moving Iran toward that secular state of being clearly a Muslim state, not an Islamic state. That is to say, like Turkey, it's going to be basically a secular state in which the people happen to be Muslim.
Right.
And that's the way he's moving. We said last time around that he had taken a number of actions, especially in the late 60s and early 70s, that alienated him from the clerical leadership, the Ayatollahs in Iran. For one thing, he began cutting back on the clerical holdings, land holdings, property that they had. He also had proposed the emancipation of women. That was a reality for the middle class, the upper middle class, and the wealthy women. It was just a reality. He wanted to make that universal. And then thirdly, he had made the decision to allow the swearing-in process of all government officials on the holy book of their choice,
mm-hmm.
whether it would be the Quran, or it could be the Bible, an Old Testament, New Testament. If it was a Christian, Old Testament. If it was the if this was a Jewish member, and this very much upset the establishment, the religious establishment. And then, to make it all the worse, he began planning for a referendum all throughout Iran to see whether or not the people would accept this. And the way things were going, it looked as though they would be accepting it. So you've got that happening, the secularization of the Iranian society. You've got the oppression of the left, especially universities, university professors, university students, many of those studying outside of Iran, and then really tasting freedom and studying in American universities, British, other universities, and then coming back to Iran and then feeling this oppression. So despite the fact that it looked like everything was going well materially, in fact, there are these two undercurrents happening. And all of this comes to a head, push comes to shove, in 1976, when you have a decline in the oil price. Up until that time, in 1973, 74, 75, oil had been inflated mm-hmm. as a result of the OPEC actions, as a result of the Yom Kippur War. And so now, in 1976, there is a rather sudden decrease in the price of oil. There are a couple of reasons for this, and probably one of the most important reasons is Western conservation. After the shock of 1973-74, Americans finally began getting a little bit more interested in fuel efficiency in their automobiles. You remember, this is the time when the Nixon administration imposed slower speed limits.
Mm-hmm.
55 became pretty much the national speed limit, with the exception of a couple of the western states. That was very unpopular. And everybody knew that no one was going to drive at 55, but it kept us driving at around 60 to 65 rather than the 75 to 80 that so many people had been used to.
Uh-huh.
And so there are just so many ways that happens. So you have a drop in the price of crude oil, 12% drop in that 1 year. And then also in the United States, you had the election of Jimmy Carter,
mm-hmm.
Which has a great importance for Shah Pahlavi. And the reason why that's important is because Carter brings in a totally different way of looking at foreign policy than the Ford administration or the Nixon administration before. And in fact, going throughout most of American history, even though in those areas where there's a certain amount of idealism, what we could call Wilsonian idealism, there's always a heavy dose of realism, too. And realpolitik was certainly what drove, more than anything else, the Nixon administration and Ford administration. So as they looked at the South Asia and looked at stability, they saw Iran as a friend and an ally, and they did everything they could to help the Shah, recognizing that the Shah had some human rights problems, especially with his secret police. Well, Carter's understanding of foreign policy is exactly the opposite. He believes that that human rights are more important than strategic partnerships. And so he is openly critical of the Shah of Iran. And this gives, the election takes place in 76. In 77, after he's inaugurated, this gives heart to the opposition within Iran. People are paying attention to what the President of the United States says. And that's including the leftists at the university and the clerics in the mosques.
Mm-hmm.
And they're paying attention. Not that they're listening to Carter and what he's saying about human rights, but that he's withdrawing his support of the Shah. And then in this vulnerable position now, where people are not as happy with him as they had been before because the economy's not as rosy as what it had been before, and now American support seems to be slipping away. And remember that this is only a few years, 3-4 years, after the United States withdrew from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, South Vietnam fell to the communists. So our credibility in the world, and certainly in South Asia, Southeast Asia, was at a low point. And while that's happening, and that's the milieu, the Iranian government made a terrible miscalculation. In January of 1978, they ran a series of newspaper articles that were critical of the Ayatollah Khomeini. Now remember, he's sitting over in Iraq, and he's critical of the government. But what they did was not just criticized him, they belittled him. They made fun of him and mocked him. And these are all government-run newspapers. And the end result was that even Muslims who were the enemy of Khomeini went to his defense to defend his honor. And so, not realizing it, the Shah actually brought together opposition,
mm-hmm.
and united his opposition against him. The demonstrations took place in the streets of Tehran. They turned bloody, and so now the turmoil is all the worse. Responding to that, then the Shah closed down the bazaars because these were huge meeting places of dissidents. That's going to have a tremendous impact on the pious bourgeoisie, because they're the ones who, that's how they make their living, is in these bazaars. And now you end up with a broad coalition of opposition. And the people who are running this opposition are none other than the Ayatollahs.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Now, at that point then, the Ayatollah Khomeini left Iraq and went to Paris. I moved to a suburb outside of Paris to continue his attacks on the Shah. Very rapidly, over the next month, there are more and more massive demonstrations. And especially around the feast of the martyrdom of the Imam Hussein. So Shiites are just really, this is a very sacred month for them, and so you have these huge demonstrations. And remember, as I mentioned before, that the Ayatollah Khomeini had painted the Shah like the Caliph of Damascus.
Right.
Remember, he's the one who had killed the Imam Hussein. And so the parallels, the historic parallels, are just really, really poignant. On December 10th and December 11th of 1978, there were massive demonstrations in Iran. Literally hundreds of thousands of people turned out. Now, they couldn't get to the Shah's palace. The police stopped them. But these hundreds of thousands all began shouting all throughout that night, Allah Akbar, God is great, all throughout the streets. And the Shah could hear them in his palace. He knew he had some real problems on his hands. And so about a month later, he decided to take a trip. And it was going to be his last trip. It's very controversial as to whether or not he was just going on vacation or whether he knew he was fleeing. But he brought his whole family with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought his entourage. And he brought an extra pair of clothing and plenty of shoes and all the other things that he might have needed if he wasn't coming back home,
mm-hmm.
and including, you know, photographs and things that were near and dear to him. So it's been argued that he simply went on vacation and brought a lot of stuff with him. But the other side of it is that it looked pretty much like he knew he wasn't coming back. On February 1st of 1979, who arrives at the airport in Tehran but none other than the Ayatollah Khomeini. And very, very quickly, Iran shifts into a theocracy. The Shah is overthrown in a bloodless coup. And now his opposition has won, but much to the chagrin of the secularists and the liberals, Khomeini crushes them now. Any opposition. He is going to introduce a theocracy based on the Sharia, on the Islamic law. During this turmoil in 1979, in November, he encourages through speeches a bunch of, I'm going to say, quote unquote, students.
Mm-hmm.
These guys, I don't know what they were studying. but he encouraged about 500 of them to invade the U.S. embassy. The Marines had plans to defend the embassy. I mean, that's what they do. They defend embassies. They had plans to defend the embassy and, if necessary, to move into a safe part of the embassy until they could be rescued. But they received the orders not to resist and not to fire upon the crowd. And as a result, the Marines were disarmed. And then they themselves became hostages. And throughout the end of 1979 and all throughout 1980, through the entire year of 1980, until January of 1981, the American embassy staff and the Marines who were there were held as hostages. Interesting thing happened also, too, just as a little aside, you know, the Iranians are famous for their Persian rugs, you know,
mm-hmm.
Persia. And many of these are hand done, of course. And what they did was they brought in expert rug weavers because the Americans, as things got more and more tense, began taking lots of secret information they had and shredded it. And it was a huge room of shredded material. You know, paper, shredded paper. You can imagine the scene. And they brought these rug workers in to begin literally page by page putting them back together again in order to get those top secret documents.
Oh,
isn't that incredible?
Gosh. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
Well, over the next year or so, things stabilized, but not necessarily to the happy results. In 1982, the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran fled from Iran. His successor was assassinated. for all practical purposes, then the Ayatollahs now were in charge. And in April of 1983, the laws of Iran were amended so that women would have to wear the veil and the burqa, the long, you know, gowns, and the Sharia was now introduced as the law of the land in Iran. This comes as a real shocker, too. I mean, an awful lot of Iranians had gotten to be pretty pretty independent and pretty westernized, and especially, you know, you could imagine the shock for women to have this. It's now that Iran enters into a great ideological war. On the one hand, you had the enemies are going to be twofold. On the one hand, you have fellow Muslims in the form of the Saudi Sunnis, who are now the enemy of the Ayatollahs. And they also have another ideological war going on, that against the great Satan, which is what Khomeini calls the United States. However, as much as he would like to have had this ideological war against these two foes, one the apostates and the other the blasphemers, he ended up with another war that he had not bargained for. And that was in September of 1980. His next-door neighbor in Iraq, Saddam Hussein, attacked into an area called the Shat al-Arab. And this is an incredibly rich oil field. It's down in the area around Basra. And so with that, there's another war underway. And this is a very hot war. Beginning the war, as the war began, in order to make sure that the Shiites within his own country would not revolt and join in with the Iranians, Saddam assassinated one of the head Ayatollahs of the Shiites. This is a man by the name of Ayatollah Bakr al-Sadr. Now, that's an interesting name, al-Sadr, because this is the father of Muhammad al-Sadr, little fat guy that we've been having so many difficulties with. That's his dad. Okay. And his father was murdered by Saddam Hussein in order to keep the Shiites down. And the Shiites had always been oppressed by Saddam. Well, now there's a propaganda war as well as a hot war that's going on. On the one hand, the Iraqis are shouting at the Iranians, saying that they're non-Arab, which is true. They're not Arabs, and that they're apostates because they follow the Shia. On the other hand, the Iranians attack the Iraqis, saying they're impious and they're apostates because the country is led by Ba'athists, which is a socialist, secular form of Islam. It really is non-religious. And so the war rages on, and it is reminiscent of the First World War. Here you have a case in which both sides throw hundreds of thousands of men at each other, and it devolves into trench warfare. For the first time, we see chemical weapons being used on the battlefield. I mean, just like World War I, mustard gas. And you know, both sides are making plenty of this stuff. And it's during that time, while this war is raging, that the Ayatollah Khomeini looks for opportunities outside of the battlefield in order to sort of like stab the Iraqis in the back and also take on the great Satan and take on the Sunni apostates. And that's where Lebanon comes in. Remember, we talked about Lebanon a little bit earlier on and how the Iranians had been giving aid and help to one particular group in Lebanon. That's the organization called the Hezbollah. It's translated as the Party of God. And they used then the Hezbollah against, on the one side, the Israeli army, which has been allied to the Christian militia. These are the Maronites. He uses them against the Syrians and the Sunnis. and he uses them against the Shia. And this goes on. It's a low-level conflict that's done through kidnappings. Basically, lots of people are being kidnapped, and they're being kidnapped for money. We shouldn't be too surprised at what is happening in Iraq. These are old tactics. They've been around the Middle East for many, many years. And so they're involved in that. There is some evidence of a link between Hezbollah, the Iranians, and the blowing up of the American Marine barracks and the French barracks also. Besides in Iraq, the same thing also took place in Kuwait. The reason why the Iranians were against the French was because the French had developed a very close relationship with Iraq. Saddam, and particularly a young man, up-and-coming young politician in France by the name of Jacques Chirac, those two had become quite good friends, and a lot of commercial ties developed between Iraq and France. And in fact, some very advanced fighter bombers were sold to Saddam, which were then used against the Iranians. So there's a good reason why Iran would hate the French and want to kill Frenchmen. In 1981, the Ayatollah Khomeini succeeded in disrupting the Hajj. I had mentioned this once before that they had done this. As many as 65,000 Iranians were on that Hajj, and they defied the Saudis. It was a big disruption. There are very few in history have been disrupted, but this was one in 1981. They tried again in 1987, and this time around the Saudis were ready for it, and they cracked down. They killed over 400 people. The Saudis killed over 400 people on pilgrimage in order to secure it at that time. In July of 1988, Iran finally accepted a ceasefire with Iraq. The fact of the matter is that Iran had no friends. They were fighting this one alone. They had used up just about all the hardware that the United States had given to the Shah. And on the other hand, the weaker of the two powers, Iraq, with Saddam Hussein, had a lot of countries rooting for them, France for sure, but along with that also Germany, the United States, and Britain were hoping that not that Saddam would win, but that Saddam would not lose.
Mm-hmm.
And what we were looking for, hoping for, was a balance of power in the Middle East between the two, so that they would be able to play one against the other and bring about some kind of stability within the Middle East and the Persian Gulf states. Now, that is that's a setback for the Ayatollah Khomeini. There's another setback that takes place, too, that he would see as a victory and most of the world would see as a defeat. And that was in February of 1989. A book had been published a couple months earlier called Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie. It's a novel, but it's not very complimentary toward Muhammad, the founder of Islam. I have not read the book, and I don't have any interest in reading it. But I was fascinated by the reception of the book in the Muslim world. The Ayatollah Khomeini announced or declared a fatwa, a declaration against, a personal declaration against personally Salman Rushdie himself. Not only, I mean, it's one thing to condemn the book, it's another thing to censor the book. But here what he did was he called upon all devout Muslims to find Salman Rushdie and kill him. Rushdie ended up in Great Britain in an undisclosed location. One of the Witness Protection Act kind of deals.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, undoubtedly would have been murdered. Interestingly enough, 3 days before the fatwa went into effect, there was a demonstration that turned into a riot in Islamabad, in Pakistan, and the rioters broke into the American Cultural Center and sacked the center, burned it, as a protest against Salman Rushdie's book. And I say, duh. I mean, what's the relationship? We didn't have that book. We weren't publishing it. But see the connection? Mm-hmm. You know, you look at the American flag, you immediately, if you're a Middle Easterner, you're immediately thinking in terms of the U.S., the West, Israel, secularism, Rushdie. We're all kind of lumped together in the minds of so many of the of these people. In January, even before, again, before the Fatwa went into effect, in January in Great Britain, in Bradford, there was a group of Muslims gathered together to take all the copies of Salman Rushdie's book they could find and burn them publicly.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and that's in England in 1989. Now, as far as the Muslim world went, Khomeini, it looked like it was great PR. But for the rest of the world, it really looked an awful lot like the Nazi book burnings and the triumph of ignorance. So, you know, what you have here is, you know, two different pictures entirely. The fact of the matter is also that as time went on throughout the 1980s, Khomeini became less and less a popular figure within his own country. There's some trends that are happening that are not terribly good. One of those is the incredible number of war dead and war wounded. When people started looking at the butcher's bill, they had to wonder. I mean, in the end, he didn't win that war, despite the fact that Iran is much larger than Iraq and certainly much wealthier. But he ended up with a compromise. Now, how do you turn around then to all these men who had sacrificed their lives and their families? How do you turn to their families? How do you turn to so many war wounded and say to them, well, you know, sorry, big misunderstanding? The veterans who are returning from this war, many of them with limbs missing, blinded, they didn't return with good pensions. They didn't have a VA hospital system. What happened to them was they were basically thrown into the lower classes. You know, a man without an arm, well, in Iranian society, that's just not real good. Mm-hmm. A blind man, not real good. You know, they had no hope for advancement. And, you know, when you think about the way we're honoring our veterans today, mm-hmm. From 2001 to 2004, it's totally different mm-hmm. than the way these guys were received when they came back. And so they brought back with them a lot of resentment. And then also, the fact of the matter is that half the population of Iran are women. And no woman was happy with the way they were being treated. Not only did they have to go around wearing those silly burqas and you know, not allowed to go to school and not allowed to read books and all the other silly things that go along with that, but also they always had to look over their shoulder at the morality police. Mm-hmm. There's a whole set of police, and they exist in Saudi Arabia also, that will beat a woman on the street simply because they don't like the way she's acting. If she goes out without a male accompaniment, if she saunters in a particular way, there is nothing to protect women in these countries against being beaten. And so the abuse was mounting up. The fact that the revolution, the Iranian revolution, which they said was going to spread all over the world, you know, that this Islamic revolution that Khomeini was introducing in 1979, the fact of the matter is it didn't spread. I mean, first of all, it had no interest out of the Shia portion of Islam, which is only 20% of Islam in itself. Mm. And by and large, most of the Shia were not real interested in the Ayatollah's concept of running a government. Even today in Iraq, which is majority Shiite, they're not necessarily looking to Iran as the model. Quite honestly, most of the Iranians are not really looking to their own country as the model. And that might account also for the fact that Iran has the lowest birth rate among all Muslim countries in the world.
Wow.
It's not that they have any kind of contraception in Iran. They don't, as in the rest of the Muslim world. The fact of the matter is that many Muslim Iranian couples simply don't want to bring children into the kind of world that they have. And so that says something. You also have a whole generation of young Iranians who have been detached from rural life. They've come into the cities, and so they don't have the old mores, customs of the old people. They haven't adopted the urban Islamic sense of the Ayatollahs. And as a result of them, many of them are just cynical. You know, they refer to the Islamic leadership as the bearded ones.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they also call them the men in black. And they're not respected. These are the young people who, many of them speak English. And they learned English not because they're studying in American universities anymore. That doesn't happen. But they're learning English because of the internet, because of radio, television. They would like to emulate the West. I remember an interview that an American journalist had with an Iranian college student just shortly after the fall of Saddam Hussein. And he was asking about a number of questions about, you know, what's your perspective on your country and all of this sort of stuff. And the young man said to this journalist, he said, "I just have one question." And the American journalist said, "Well, what's that?" And this young man from Iran, this college student, said, "When are the Americans coming to free us too?" Wow. And there's a whole generation of people that have that attitude toward their own government. Now, a good example of this is in 1999 when they celebrated the 20th anniversary of the revolution. It was like it was a celebration and nobody showed up.
Mm.
You know, they had what they call the pious foundations that held these gatherings. It's basically an alliance of the Ayatollahs on the one hand and the bazaar merchants on the other.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is that Iran is stuck in a bazaar. Well, that is bizarre for sure. That's an adjective. But, you know, in the mentality of these bazaars, which is a wonderful way to do commerce
mm-hmm.
in the Middle Ages.
Uh-huh.
But it is not modern at all. And that's where Iran is stuck. And as a result, the vast majority of people in Iran are simply unhappy when they look around the west of the world and see progress taking place. They could look over to the east and see Afghanistan, which was, you know, it was a terrible dump of a country, but it's really making progress. Look what's happening in the schools, the election that just took place recently, government's being formed, roads are being built. People are actually looking at ways of investing in Afghanistan. When you look at Pakistan, another neighbor to the east, the Pakistani economy has just exploded, taken off incredibly. It's one of the fastest growing economies in the world. And then look over in the other direction and look at Iraq. Now, Iraq is in terrible shape. It's got lots of insurgency. But on the other hand, the infrastructure is building up beautifully. They've got schools. Things are happening that hadn't been happening before. And so the Iranians are standing in the middle of this going, "Hey, back in the 70s, I mean, we really had things going. You know, who messed this up?"
Mm-hmm.
Old bearded ones
mm-hmm.
dressed in black, you know. In 1997, there was an election, and one of the Ayatollahs, a man by the name of Mohammad Khatami, ran as a candidate for change, and he won the election. Now, he's an Ayatollah. But he won the election handily. When he got into office, he began change, but at a glacial speed. I mean, they're frustrated. He's been in office for 7 years, and not a heck of a lot has happened yet. It's moving, but not much. Basically, Mohammad Khatami has been stymied because of a clash between parliament on the one side and the parliament had been made up of reformers, people who backed him, that wanted to move the Iranian Revolution to the next step, you know, mm-hmm. and modernize Iran, get better relations with the West, and those sorts of things. On the one hand, you had that. On the other hand, you've got a group called the Supreme Guide of the Revolution. It's like the Supreme Court in a sense because it interprets all the laws. So Parliament can pass all the laws they want. They can work with President Khatami all they want. But when the Supreme Guide of the Revolution steps in, everything gets squashed.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In February of 2000, there was another election, and the Parliament was heavily dominated by reformists. They won handily. But all of a sudden, the courts turned around and disqualified many of them. In 2004, there was another election. In other words, earlier this year, it was a dud. The reason why it was a dud was because almost all of the candidates on the reform side were disqualified by the Supreme Guide of the Revolution. So the end result is, you know, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now there's hope in that,
right?
And because there's so much disgruntled feeling among so many people, once again I go back to Giles Keppel in his book Jihad, and he concludes that the best example that we have today of Islamism, this jihad concept, is Iran. And the fact of the matter is that the Iranian Revolution and the Iranian Revolutionary Government is bankrupt. I don't mean financially. I mean bankrupt morally. The people themselves have no faith in their government. As a result of that, in Iran, as much as in Iraq, and certainly in Afghanistan, the people themselves are looking for things like human rights, democracy, freedom, and the basic grounding is that these aren't Western ideas. Mm-hmm. These are human ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you don't have to be from Europe or America to have a longing for just human respect and dignity. And the human rights and civil rights that go with that, of democracy, liberty, those things are not necessarily, I mean, they might have been first named by Western Enlightenment characters and embodied in, for instance, in American history, but they don't belong just to us.
Right.
Every human being has that longing.
All inside, we all.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah, and you can see time after time after time that either people achieve it or they strive for it. And Keppel points out a number of examples of this. First of all, in the failure of Islamism to attract in a permanent way large numbers of Muslims, because if it did, you've got a billion Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
That would be irresistible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but obviously it has not, and Keppel points that out. First of all, the attempts at Islamic revolution, violent revolutions in Algeria and Egypt have failed. Now, they took many years, and thousands of people died from terrorist attacks. These are internal terrorist attacks trying to force Algeria to become an Islamic state. Not a Muslim state, but an Islamic state. Same thing in Egypt, and it failed. You know, it's failed in other locations also. Ultimately, it failed in Afghanistan, mainly because of external forces coming in, particularly the United States Army. But it failed. In the struggle of Palestinians against Israel, the violence against Israel has been, in the end, ineffective. It has not changed Israeli foreign or domestic policy. So somewhere down the line, the Palestinians are going to realize that they've got to come up with another plan besides going into pizza parlors and blowing themselves up. There has to be a better way to do this. And perhaps with the passing of Yasser Arafat, other more creative minds can pursue that.
Mm-hmm.
Although I heard a journalist say just a week or two ago that the Palestinians have historically never passed up an opportunity to pass up an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. I have greater hope than that. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. Also, you have the Islamic Islamists. Islamist failures in the Sudan, which is still being played out, and many, many people are being killed.
Mm-hmm.
Christians in the south, black Muslims in the west, in Darfur. But nonetheless, the Islamic revolution and the establishment of Sharia in that country, the largest country in Africa, has not succeeded. Afghanistan was not a success by any terms. Certainly what the Taliban did showed the ugliest of whatever that dream world would be. It's not a dream world, it's a nightmare world.
Mm-hmm.
You have sectarian violence in Pakistan, but Pakistan moving toward establishing itself as a Muslim state, not an Islamic state. This is under Perez Musharraf. Also in Malaysia, in Indonesia, the failure of dictators in those areas. They've got a long way to go, but the fact that they went to the ugliest extreme and it failed. People in those areas also are longing for freedom, economic freedom, political freedom, human freedom. There has been a failure to soften secularism in Turkey and in Jordan. In both of those countries, in the last couple of years, both of those countries have experienced terrorist attacks. Usually they're on page 3 or page 4 of our newspapers, but they're on page 1 in those countries.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they've continued to be under attack, yet they have refused to allow these jihadist thugs to dictate terms for them. The great question, of course, is for us is whether or not Iraq is going to become a democratic country and a beacon of democracy in the Middle East. It certainly can be. It's not the largest country in the Middle East, but it's a very important one. If the Shiite Sunnis and Kurds can learn to live together, and we'll find out in 2 months, because the election is coming up in January.
Mm-hmm.
If that election takes place, if it's a clean election, and if it's decisive, as the one in Afghanistan was, that's going to be a major step moving people toward democracy. And the other thing that's important in this, too, is it's going to show, you know, Pope John Paul II has called upon the Lebanese people to accept the challenge of learning to live together. You know, there's so many different forms of Muslims, of Christians living in that one country, and to be able to learn to live together will be a lesson for everybody else in the world on how to live together. The Iraqis are presented the same challenge. If those three groups, the Sunni, the Shia, and the Kurds, can live together, and along with that a very tiny Christian minority, about 3% of the population, if they could learn to live together and democracy is brought about, that's going to be a major step.
Yeah.
And then the same thing is also true if the Iranians can see what's happening in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they are able to move their country in that same direction and force change in Iran for the better. Now, there's a lot of ifs.
Right.
But if that's true, then what that means is that the great challenge that we have going into the 21st century, that of global terrorism, what that means is that global terrorism, that jihadist terrorism, is in fact not the wave of the future. It's a last gasp. Now, I point out that in Egypt and in Afghanistan, I'm sorry, in Egypt and in Algeria, this struggle went on for 10 years, and it's not entirely over yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that we can turn around and say, well, we'll give it 6 months.
No.
You know, this is long term. But if all of these presumptions are correct, it would mean that the jihadists are in the midst of their last gasp. In other words, they're like the Japanese kamikazes right at the end of the war. That was not a new tactic. That was the end.
Mm-hmm.
That was the last gasp. Same thing is also true of, you know, the SS units in Nazi Germany, when they brought in young teenage and pre-teenage boys into those units. When after the war was over, they set up a terrorist groups called the it was an operation called the Werewolves. We don't pay much attention to that, but the fact of the matter is that American GIs continued being killed after the Second World War as occupying Germany, 1945, 1946, 1947. I don't think it was until 1947 and 1948 that we didn't take casualties in our occupying forces there from these werewolf operations. That was a last gasp of Nazism, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that's what happened. But the big question, of course, is it going to be possible for Islam to go from a medieval mentality to a 21st century postmodern mentality? It hasn't been easy for Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been struggling with this for a good 400 years, accommodating ourselves to secularism, also bringing the gospel in. By generation, nation by nation, society by society, culture by culture, we have continued doing that, but we've also learned we've learned to live together,
right.
And that's the question as to whether or not Iran is going to be able to, Iraq is going to be, the Muslim world is going to be able to do that. You know, during the Iran-Iraq War back in the early 80s, Pope John Paul II sent a personal representative, Cardinal Roger Echeverry, I believe his name was. He's a Frenchman. And he sent him to Baghdad and then sent him to Tehran to try to find ways to seek peace. And while he was there in both of those countries, here is a Roman Catholic cardinal visited the POW camps in each country, visiting the POWs of each other's sides, and tried to arrange something similar to what Benedict the 15th had done in the First World War. Do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
An office of prisoners, and so that they could get information back and forth to each other's families and possible exchanges and things of that nature. Now, picture this. Here are two Muslim forces fighting each other, and here's a Roman Catholic cardinal representing the Pope trying to ameliorate the suffering of each other's POWs.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting model for us. Now, the interesting thing also is that the cardinal was not operating as a Vatican diplomat as such. He was operating as the personal representative of the Pope. What has been termed a parallel personal diplomacy. Cardinal Echeverry was asked about the relationship with John Paul II and the Vatican diplomats and these two countries, and he said the following. He said the Pope, John Paul II, was, quote, above but not outside politics.
Mm.
So this is an important insight, I think, for us as we look at the Vatican's role in the Middle East in a very contemporary way, is that John Paul II sees himself above politics, but not outside of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's going to have a role to play in Middle Eastern things, but his whole hope is to bring about a higher moral standard, you know, to get out of the mud wrestling and develop a higher standard in all of that. That is going to lead to frustration and a confusion of purposes. I mean, an example of this is the question that many American Catholics had back in the early 90s when the United Nations had a mandate in 1990 for collective security against Saddam Hussein when he invaded Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, the Vatican, which of course doesn't have a vote at the United Nations, nonetheless spoke against the mandate. You know, how is this possible? Well, we always have to keep in mind that Vatican foreign policy has, certainly for the last couple hundred years regarding the Middle East, we always keep this in mind, the traditional goals of the protection of the minorities, and particularly the Christian minorities, and the security of the holy places. Mm-hmm. And that leads to a nuanced understanding of world peace by Pope John Paul II. I remember most recently in the Second Gulf War, in the most recent war in March of 2003, there was an editorial that ran in many U.S. newspapers by former President Jimmy Carter, in which he condemned the war. That's very strange for an American president to openly come out against American foreign policy. Mm-hmm. But he condemned the war based upon the just war theory. And what he did was he listed a series of just war suppositions, and then afterward, and then went one after another in doing that. Interestingly enough, he did that, but Pope John Paul II didn't.
Right.
He was not in favor of this war, and in fact, did everything he could to prevent it. But he never used the just war theory in doing that. He's trying to elevate statesmanship above, as I said before, elevate statesmanship to moral principles. And so let's go ahead and take a look at how he does that. Particularly, let's look at the two Gulf Wars in doing that. You know, on August 2nd of 1990, Iraq invaded Kuwait. There were two reasons for this. The key reason was oil and money. Saddam Hussein had borrowed a lot of money from his weak neighbor, which is always a dangerous thing for weak neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And his way of paying back the Kuwaitis was to invade their country, to wipe out the debt, and then to steal their oil. And, of course, this invasion was incredibly brutal. The stories of torture and murder in that little country was just horrible. And the second reason to invade Kuwait was it opened up the possibility of invading Saudi Arabia. And if he had succeeded in doing that, the Saudis could not have stood against him. Their army was simply nowhere near strong enough. They could not have had any alliances in the area to have helped them out. It would take a long time to bring major forces to bear to protect Saudi Arabia. It would have been over very quickly, and the end result is that the Saudis would have experienced the same torture chamber horrors that the Kuwaitis did, and Saddam would have now gotten control of the single largest source of oil in the world.
Mm-hmm.
He would have been an economic power to contend with. On August 28th, now this is on August 2nd, the invasion takes place. On August 28th, the Pope responds as condemnations are coming in from all over the world against Saddam. He says the following, and I quote, that this was a serious violation of international rights and the United Nations Charter. And then went on to urge a diplomatic solution, but at all costs to avoid armed conflict. What happens instead is that through the UN mandate, the coalition forces led by the United States, but many, many other countries also, began building up, once they received permission to come into Saudi Arabia, began building up what was known as Desert Shield. Okay. And it looked as though this was more than a defensive army. This army was meant to move,
mm-hmm.
and everyone knew that. And so on January 4th, a letter was sent by the Pope. This is January 4th, 1991, was sent by the Pope to all of the European foreign ministers urging peace. Most of these guys had troops in Saudi Arabia now. On January 11th, he contacted the United Nations Secretary General. This is Javier Perez de Cuellar, who was just about to travel to Baghdad for one last effort to bring about peace, and encouraged him to do everything he could to persuade Saddam to leave Kuwait and therefore avoid war. On the 15th, he sent Pope John Paul II sent an appeal specifically to Saddam Hussein, asking him to back out of Kuwait. He could do this easily enough because the foreign minister of Kuwait was Tariq Aziz, a Christian. Despite the fact that Christians make up only 3% of the population, the foreign minister was himself. On the 16th, the very next day, he then called President Bush. This is George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush Sr., again telling him that he was praying for peace. The president told the Pope that it didn't look real good for peace, and that things were happening very quickly. The fact of the matter is that when Bush hung up, within a matter of a couple hours, Desert Shield turned into Desert Storm. And at 1 o'clock in the morning on January 17th of 1991, the coalition forces then began a massive attack on Iraq. First of all, with 7 days of air assault, bombing all of the command and control communication centers, and then 4 days of a land battle, this happening between 24th and 28th of February of 1991. It happened very, very quickly. It was a massive victory, an incredible victory on the part of the coalition forces. There are a number of reasons for that that I won't go into, but the end result is that when the whole thing was over, in a matter of a week and a half, people looked around, and certainly in the Vatican, they had to look around and recognize that they were absolutely powerless to have prevented war, and that they were absolutely outmaneuvered in that they had been ignored. No, there had been no briefing by the United States to Vatican sources. This is very different. I mentioned before that President Reagan did almost nothing without contacting Vatican sources.
Mm-hmm.
Those two worked hand in glove on so many things in order, for one thing, just to bring freedom and democracy to Eastern Europe, which many people, myself included, would have said that would never have happened in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they succeeded in doing that. Here you have a different kind of an approach in which the Vatican and Washington was not talking to each other. The new Secretary of State had just been installed 6 weeks earlier. This is Cardinal Sodano. He was totally unaware of what was about to happen. The Catholic Patriarch in Iraq, this is the Patriarch Raphael Bidawid, had supported Saddam, and now, again, totally outmaneuvered. It looked as though, there's a confusion here, it looked as though the church's diplomatic arm was trying to protect this brutal dictator. It looks that way,
mm-hmm.
You know. And yet the fact of the matter is that what John Paul II was trying to do was have a very clear criteria for the use of force. And, you know, he has a quote that was plastered everywhere by opponents to this war and to the Second Gulf War. And it goes like this: in war, there are no winners, only losers. He did say that.
Mm-hmm.
But he got so much of that thrown back at him that in February of 1991, literally days before the war itself began, he said in an audience, and I quote again, "We are not pacifists at any cost." You know, so
mm-hmm.
it's important for us not to misunderstand him on that. He's not going to go quietly as Benedict the 15th did. Right after the war took place, and as I say, the whole thing was over in 11 days.
Mm-hmm.
Right after the war took place, on March 4th and 5th of 1991, the Pope called together to the Vatican the bishops of all the belligerents. So he had the bishops of the countries of the United States, Great Britain, France, Italy, Belgium, the North African bishops, the patriarchs of the Middle Eastern countries, all brought to the Vatican for a two-day conference to consider what the church can do to ameliorate the problems of the Middle East and bring about peace. Ultimately, there was a document that was published called Peace in the Middle East, which is John Paul II's plan for that peace. It was published by the Vatican Press. However, it's been lost to history.
All right, Father, shall we close with prayer?
Yeah. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.